This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Few parents will know the difficulty of raising a terminally ill child. Marhaini Mustafa has documented the trials and triumphs of her daughter's life, who was diagnosed with a brain tumor at age 4 and lived until she was 18. The book is called Caring for Marissa, and Marhaini joins me now to discuss how her family coped with her daughter's failing health. Welcome to the show, Marhaini.
Hi, Lin. How are you?
Firstly, why did you decide to write this book about your daughter?
I felt that her story, her life, was something to be told. And also, mainly, I didn't want her memory to die when I died, actually.
So that was the...
the main reason, yes.
Okay.
Because I thought she fought so hard. So I just wanted that, basically.
Could you tell us what her condition was and how you first discovered it, when it first kind of came into your lives?
She was about 4 that time, and she was floppy. She was always so tired and lethargic. And at that age, I already took her for piano classes. She couldn't press on her keys. And her school teacher, she was really sweet. She said, I think you should take her to the doctor because she seems to be a bit too, not like, progressing like the other kids. So that's when we decided she's the doctor.
And what did the doctor find?
We went for the MRI because we were advised to, of course, and found out that there was a tumor in her brainstem area, which was already large, actually, to begin with. At her age, it was about 4.5 centimeters. So to them, it was already large in size.
What went through your head when the doctor told you about it, when you first saw it?
That I had to fight. I had to fight for her. That was as simple as that. I didn't think of anything else. I didn't think about her being sick. I just knew that I had to fight for her. That was my duty as a mom.
Once they told you and showed you the tumor, which, as you say, was considered large for somebody her age, what next? I mean, did the doctors take you through next steps? Did they, what were your options?
There wasn't much option, actually, because first of all, the doctor said that it was in the brainstem area, which was very hard to access. They said, I remember him telling it's like a bowl of rice. It's like trying to get to the bottom of the rice. So imagine you have to move all the things in a head. They were most probably bound to touch something they shouldn't. So we were basically asked to go home that night itself, and we weren't given much time. To just spend as much time as we could with her. That was actually her prognosis at that time.
Did they give you an estimate of how much time she would have?
About 2 years.
Okay. And that was when she was 4?
She was 4 then. So I couldn't accept it. I mean, I didn't want anyone to tell me, 2 years. So we did our research. We went on and did sort of alternative treatments. And we actually, of course, medically went to many doctors and her MRIs all over the world. In the end, we did find her doctor in Perth.
What was that doctor able to do for you that the doctor here could not?
I think because it was a very risky surgery, most of all. There was one doctor who was willing, but it was too aggressive. They wanted to take out her skull apart, basically take out her, her jaw, and to get to the tumour was really difficult. And I didn't want that for a 4-year-old, because she was still so young. So we did seek a lot of treatment until we found that the doctor that was willing to help us.
So since since you opted for the less aggressive procedure, can you tell us about that? What was that procedure like, and how did it affect her health?
The surgery in Perth was actually quite aggressive. That was the only surgery, two surgeries we went for. That one was aggressive. It was a 10-hour surgery. They cut right through her head, and they had her C1 and C2 removed. But even with that, 10 hours, they were only able to remove 1 centimeter of a tumor, which was actually, we were just happy with that her life could be extended. We wanted her, the quality of her life, and we wanted her to just be with us a bit longer. So we were okay with that because we've had bad news all her life that was, yay, that was good.
What was it like did you try to explain to Marissa what was happening with her health? I mean, I'm sure as she progressed, she lived till she was 18, and along, I'm sure there would have been a lot more complex discussions about
True.
Where her health was headed. But at the age of 4 and 5, how do you tell somebody that this is happening and this is why we have to take you here, this is why the doctors have to do this?
She was amazing. She never grumbled. She never questioned. That was the thing about her until, I think, the day she died. she never complained. So that was the thing with her, that she changed my life. And the only time I actually really brought it up with her was when she was going to turn 18. And I said, you know, Marisa, you've lived this long and you know your condition. Do you want us to do something more aggressive for you? Because we'll do it, I told her. And she's like, no, mom. She actually told me that you know, she's okay as she is. And but when she was younger, she never argued. She never asked. She trusted us completely. So that put a bit of weight on me and my husband as parents.
To make those decisions.
To make those decisions for her. And being in that position, you never know whether it's right or wrong. You don't know. You will never know.
What were your guiding principles when making those health decisions? Because it's so hard. I mean, you're choosing for someone else and you're choosing for someone else who's so precious to you.
Well, importantly, I wanted her to be happy. I actually had three things. I remember the cycle of my life with her. I wanted her to be well for her health. But that didn't work, actually, after we tried so many things. Somewhere I gave up. And I wanted her to be happy. I realized her happiness was the most important thing. So that's when, after trying so many things, you know, locally and overseas and everything, so I thought, okay, we're just going to live your life to the fullest. We'll do everything and anything we can for you. Just let's do it. So that's what we did.
You mentioned that in the end, you opted for two surgeries. So the first one was the one in Perth, 10 hours,
yes.
1 centimeter.
Yep.
And what happened in the second?
The second one, she went in. And the doctor actually came out halfway and they said they can't even get through her. There's a dura perilla, something that blocks. They couldn't even get through that. It was too difficult. So actually they opened her up and closed her back up after that, after consulting us halfway. So that was a bit, I mean, my hope died actually on that day. It just...
Yeah, that's a blow.
Yeah, that's a blow. And that was the only doctor that was willing to help her. He was the only one. So I just felt, oh gosh, okay, we have to think of something else, do something else. So that was it.
And after that happened, after that blow, you know, how did you recover from that? What was the next plan since this didn't happen, but you said, okay, you know, we're going to keep fighting, we're going to keep working at this?
We obviously still looked for alternative treatments. Then we went back to the simpler stuff like diets and all those, and we maintained a physiotherapy for her. But, you know, with time, she actually deteriorated. We could see that because she moved less and less and less. And she became unhappy. I could see it on her face and it was hard to see her. It's just hard seeing her. That's when I just totally changed. I said, happiness. Just let us just do whatever she wants without anything. No aggressive intervention because she didn't want it. She didn't like hospitals. She hated it. And I understood that it was hard. And she was a person who preferred to be on her own. She was quite an introvert. Yes. And I think it's because she's been sick her whole life. But she was positive the whole time. She kept on saying, you know, mom, I think I'm okay because I've been sick my whole life. She would say that. And she's okay with it. She didn't cry. There was no tears coming out of her. I think I'm the one who couldn't see her. But I think she was stronger than me, I think.
When did you decide to stop having regular MRIs done?
After the second surgery. Actually, it was more my husband's decision because it emotionally took a toll on me every time we did. And we had the same thing every year. I think I mentioned this book. We had the same radiologists who would give me a certain look, and the nurses, and they mean well. I mean, nothing against, you know, that. They will pat me on the back and I would know the results without reading the MRI. It's like, okay, fine, okay, so that's okay. So I thought, okay, I lose hope every time I see that. So I just wanted positivity in my life. I just wanted that. I needed my strength. So it was easier sometimes to keep my life in where I can control, in an environment where it's controlled by me and her. That was easier to deal with such situations, I felt.
But a part of living with the illness, I assume, was physiotherapy.
Yes.
What was that process like?
Once a week, then it went down to twice a week. But I think towards the end, she requested that we reduce it because the truth is, in her condition, it helped to a certain point, but she was never going to fully recover or fully walk or write or, you know, wipe her tears off her eye, you know, or whatever, all that. She couldn't do it. She knew it, but she never said it. So in the end, she actually requested that we reduced it. And altogether, in the end, she just said, Mom, I'd rather just be home with you. So it was always hard for me to leave her because I was her only friend, basically. So that was it. So we had people coming over, physiotherapists. After she refused to go out, we had some come in and help her.
I'm speaking today with Marhaini Mustafa, author of Caring for Marissa, a memoir of grief and healing. We're finding out more from Marhaini about the process of caring for a terminally ill child, but also the triumphs of doing so. Up next, we find out more about how the people around Marhaini reacted to Marissa's condition. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me today, Marhaini Mustafa, author of Caring for Marissa, a memoir of grief and healing. And we're talking about exactly that. So we've talked about Marissa's condition, mm-hmm. how you first found out about it when she was four, how you went from trying to kind of fix it as far as possible
yeah.
before deciding, okay, let's focus on her happiness. How did the people around you in your life, your friends, you know, react to Marissa's condition?
Oh, I've been blessed. I'm surrounded by supportive family members, friends who understood me. So that was never a problem. I had good support.
How important was it to have that good support?
Very, very important. And I think Marissa's life was just filled with love. And after thinking about it, I think she survived that long because she knew she was loved. And the thing is, we never treated her any differently, which I feel seriously is very important, that we made her feel as part of the family and that she's as normal as the rest of us, even though she couldn't move. And we joked around. We sometimes, you know, I had my nephew who said, come on, Marissa, get going, do your push-ups. And she will giggle and laugh and never actually take it seriously, you know. So that was good, that she made light of things and she loved to joke, because we wanted her to be normal as possible.
Well, that was something that I wanted to ask you earlier, you know, when you were talking about how you wanted to make sure that as far as possible her life was what it could be, what she wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
How did you do that without spoiling her? Because I can imagine that it would have been so easy to end up, you know, inadvertently just really giving her everything in that sense.
I gave her my time, and we all just gave her time, and we tried our best to put aside material stuff, and we went on holidays so that she could see the world, you know, that is for her to be able to see what's beyond the home and beyond school, because she did go to school for a while. And I think she appreciated it, and she loved books. I mean, that was the main reason I wrote as well.
And that's travel as well.
Travel. She loved it. So that was it. I mean,
you did say in the book that you gave up your social life after Marissa's diagnosis. Why did that happen? Why did you feel that it was something you needed to do?
I looked at her every day since she was four when she was diagnosed. And she was needy. She was kind of needy, but I don't blame her. And she's always asking me, Mom, where are you going? How long are you going? And the thing is, it reached a point where I couldn't leave the house without worrying about her at the back of my head. So if I had to go out, I would leave her with my mom or someone to care for her. But I did find my own time, because I need to maintain my sanity and my individualism. I had to be a person. I cannot forget that I am also still Marhaini, besides being a mom and wearing all the other hats.
You can't care for somebody if you're not caring for yourself. Yeah.
So I go for runs, or, you know, and have a lovely son who will take care of her while I go out for dinner dates with my husband, or we'll catch a movie, but we'll do it once we're settled with her. And I'll tell her, I said, Marissa, okay, we'll have to do this. She said, oh, please go, Mom. And she's the one who said, okay, how was it? How was your day? How was your run? And I remember days when my little girls, they're little, so they get on my nerves sometimes. They're kids, you know, and she'll say, Mom, I think you need to go for your run, because, you know, I think they're getting to you. I think you're right, Marissa. So, you know, we'll have that conversation with her. She knew. She understood me so well. So I did have my own time, but I preferred to keep it small so that I could be in my own thoughts. Actually, I mean, decisions are easier that way when there's not so many people. And I think between me and my husband, we have this understanding that we don't say too many things to each other, but we have an understanding. So that was good in bringing her up, because I think if we had too many opinions, and it would just be difficult to bring her up, you know, knowing that she needed extra care and all that.
It also sounds like you had a good friendship with her, which is not something that many parents, well, not not to say not many, but it's not always common, I think, for parents to be good friends with their children. And I think that's one of the great things about having slightly older children, because you get to be able those kinds of conversations.
True.
Yeah.
Yes.
What was that like for you to have to be able to forge that friendship?
It's wonderful, you know, because I grew up with her. So I went through her high school musical with her, her Twilights, and I'd be like, maybe I was a young mom. So that helped, you know. So we had the same interests, and as we grew, she grew with me. And that was great. She'd watch TV and we'll have discussion, and books again. She'd read books and we'll discuss. And I have all those things, you know, which was something I treasured, because I knew I didn't know how much time. And that was why it was hard, because not only I was her friend, I was her caregiver as well.
Were her siblings able to understand her conditions and her needs? So you have one other boy and three other girls.
Two smaller daughters, yes. And God, I give all of them duties. It's like with the house, I'm on discipline. I'm on a schedule all the time. Okay, you do this. You have to feed Kaka Marsh. And I'll tell the brother, by the time you come back from school, you have to update her Instagram or whatever, because she started off with Facebook. And she could still go on the computer. So she'd update her status. And then it went on to IG and Twitter. So she still has those accounts that her brother updates, or even her dad updates for her, or her little sisters, you know, all of us. So I give everyone a duty so that they have that sense of duty to their sisters, because I always worried about, okay, if something would happen to me, let's say, God knows, you know, someone else must know, to be responsible, must feel the responsibility towards their sister. So I did that, and I think everyone knew that. The family knew that. It wasn't so difficult. There were some moments, but generally I'm blessed there too. The kids are wonderful.
How did you arrange for Marissa's education? You mentioned that she went to school for a bit.
She went for school, standard one, took out the surgery. Then I actually went to the Jabatan Pendidikan Selangor, I got all the documents, and she went to another school under Pendidikan Khas. So I met with the Guru Besar and all that just to get in. So she's actually set for UPSR. And she stopped going at Form 1, because I think after that she was already slowly deteriorating. She couldn't stand school. She was physically tired. And in the end, she said, no, Mom, I don't think I can stand school. But at least she had that. At least I gave that bit of her life, you know, for school.
What was it like for her attending school itself?
Well, the thing is, she was in Pendidikan Khas. She was mentally she's fine. Physically, she was disabled. So she was in a class where they are mentally disabled kids. So she didn't quite fit in. She was there, but I don't think she was completely happy. Not in an environment where I would have loved her to be, but at least she felt that, you know, and she never grumbled again as usual.
Did you find that there was enough support from the education system when you were trying to find a way, you know, to get Marissa that education?
There was, but I wish it was better, because I'm sure there are many, many, many kids in her situation that could do with education, or at least normalcy to the best, you know, ability that the government can provide for us. And I would have loved that. The sense of belongingness, to be part of school, you know, most of us don't appreciate being in school, but there's nothing being associated. You're like in school, you have a family, you have somewhere to go to. For her, she doesn't have all that. And even when she was in school, she didn't quite blend in. So I do wish that was more for her in the education part. Yeah.
You mentioned just now Facebook and Instagram and social media, and there is something that I wanted to ask you about that. But before that, you also write about it in the book, and I was wondering if you could perhaps read us a little excerpt from it.
Okay. Writing this book was hard because I had to go through all your things, your social network and so on. I was doing a research on you online. I found some things about you that I didn't know, and that was a pleasant surprise. I'm not so tech unsavvy after all, eh? You're such a good person and a lovely child. I want people to know how positive you were despite all the suffering you had to endure. It's hard for me to talk to people, so I wrote this book in hope that others will be inspired by your courage and your fortitude.
What did you find out about Marissa that you didn't already know?
She had this blog called Noticeable, and I think it was something she started when started when she was still able to use, when she was on the computer. So my niece actually told me, she said, you know, Chu, you should really check it out. So she actually did blog quite a bit. And she even did a video, which I'm thinking, oh God, she started when she was like 11 or 12. Even I can do that now. You know, I'm not very good with these things. So I mean, she did a video clips with all her cousins, and she loved her cousins. And when she blogged about her disability and how she didn't like being stared at. You know, she said she shouldn't be that. Please don't stare at people on the wheelchair. It's not nice. And those sort of things about how she loved, you know, life. But even that in her blog is full of happiness. She's so happy. So it was nice. I was crying when I read it. But the good thing is that she was happy.
I think it's lovely that you can find out, like, you know, really, like any other parent in any other situation, that your child has a whole other life online. Because that is just a true fact. I know, that's always the case.
This is a good thing.
What role did social media play in her life overall? Was it very important to her?
Yes, I think it was her window to the other world. You know, that's why most of us are stuck on our phones now. It was a good thing for her because she could tell me. She would say, oh, mom, you know, this. It was like her little gossip thing with me or whatever. You know, this star is going to, there's the new Twilight movie coming out. She was obsessed with Twilight. So I liked it because she felt that she belonged to, you know, the other world or whatever is out there.
Was it easy for her to make friends?
No. She was happier not to, I think. She chose not to. Because if I ask her if she'd like to just hang or something, she's happier to be with someone she's comfortable with. But I think because she's in her comfort zone and she knows she's not easy to manage. She knows that physically it's hard to move her. And then she was always comfortable with me because it was just the main family that could manage her. So she'd rather not flop because sometimes she could get spasms if she's out or, you know, she would flop and she's embarrassed to ask. So I think she'd rather be where she's comfortable. I understand that.
But you were talking about how she's generally a very positive person.
Yes, yes.
Did her emotions or her outlook change as her condition deteriorated?
Yes, definitely. You could see it in her because actually everyone's life, she grew up with her cousins. Her cousins' life progressed like ours. You know, we move on, we do different things and we, you know, get married. But hers stopped and hers reduced because she moved less. She did less things. So I could see that, you know, she tried, she didn't ever say it, but I could see it in her face like, oh, you know, she's getting married or she has a boyfriend. And it got to the point where she said, Mom, do you think I'll ever have a boyfriend? Oh, God, that hit me because, you know, that was, that did it to me. Will I find my prince? She asked me. I think this was just before she turned 18. And, you know, I couldn't answer that because if she did, I would be so happy for her. So I worried. I worried about her. I said, okay, I don't know how to help her this way. It got to the point where the older she got, I didn't know how to help her. I was hope, you know, there was no hope. I lost a lot of hope because I could help her when she was younger. But her needs as she grew up were different than when she was little. I was enough when she was little. I'm not enough for her anymore.
She wants what every other teenage
girl
wants.
Yes, that's fine. I mean, it is definitely true. It is fair for her to have all that. That's how life should be. So I could see it in her face because that is just life.
How did you cope with that, with having those changing needs, those different questions coming up? Because in some ways, of course, it's a unique situation. And mm-hmm. yet in other ways, you know, that question is one that many mothers will face eventually, many parents will face eventually, this mm-hmm. this worry, these worries about love and life and growing older and, you know, growing up.
I cried a lot. I cried a lot. I used to do it on my own. But I have to be strong in front of everyone else. I always felt that. If my children and my family sees me not being strong, then they cannot go through this with me. And she will not be able to go through it because she needs to be strong. So she needs me to be strong. So generally when in front of people, I'm okay. But I like that moments of my sadness and tears to just be mine. So I have that moment. And usually when I do is when I'm writing because that's how I let go of, you know, share my emotions. But with her, with everyone else, strength is very important, I think, for other people, for the family, especially for the kids.
What did you learn from her and the way that she handled her condition and lived her life?
I think I am today because of her. I think I'm strong because of her. I don't think it... There was no such word as... I could not say that I'm scared. I cannot see her with her bed sores that I can't see. Because she was so brave. She was okay with it. She went through surgery and everything else in life. And she was fine. I mean, I'm thinking, okay, my child can do this. How can I not? You know? I should be more than that. So that's how I went through life. And I think the whole family, we are who we are and what we are now because of her. And I think I still talk about her is a reminder to myself what, you know, I should be and the kind of mother I should be to my other children. So my expectations have changed slowly towards my other kids.
Marissa lived till her 18th birthday.
Yes.
Considering at first you were told she would live to see her 6th, right?
Yes.
Which is, you know, three times more.
Yes. Yes.
Did you always feel that there was hope that there would be a cure, or were you focused on the now, on making the now better?
Okay, when she turned 18, or towards her 18th birthday, she was even hopeful. She said things like, Mom, maybe my life, I'm going to be okay, because she's older, so she's starting to open up to me. But I think maybe I'm going to be okay. I think maybe you are, Marissa, I said. So, you know, there's always this talk about, okay, when I turn 18, I'm going to drive off. And she knew, we knew her condition. I said, okay, you're going to have to take Aya's car. And we'll won't tell him, and we'll joke about it, you know. And she said, you know, she looked forward to true life. And I think the one of the few movies we watched before she passed away was the one of Stephen Hawking. So we were saying, okay, maybe, you know, Marissa, this is you. I said, you know, this is you. She said, yeah, maybe, mommy, maybe you're right. So we gave each other hope a lot. And I think, well, God knew better. Week after her 18th birthday, she passed away. So that was hard. It's always hard to watch your child, especially when you have that conversation about how she's going to be fine. And the next minute she's gone. So that's hard.
Is it possible ever to have prepared for that? Because to me, it seems as if it's always sitting in balance, right? You need the hope on one hand because that's the thing that will keep you going.
Yes.
But you also need to know what's happening because you need to deal with what's actually in front of you. You know, how did you... Were you prepared? Did you spend her life preparing?
No. I think I lived by the day, one thing, and then in that way, I'm also glad I didn't do my MRI, because if I did know how much this tumor has spread, it'll be make me worse off. I wouldn't have these conversations with her. I'll most probably be thinking death all the time. So at least I live with her as she would live forever and just make her life matter, you know, day by day. So that was important to me, so that I won't live with regrets, that she won't live with thinking, okay, you know, this so and all that. So yeah, that was it. But no, you will never be prepared for your child there, even though I had 14 years to supposedly prepare myself for it. No, definitely not.
No, I didn't think that. I didn't think it would be possible. How has Marissa's memory shaped the way you and your family live your life today? Because of course you still have, you know, you still have children to raise. You still have, you know, you're still living as a family.
Yes, well, we talk about her. And I think was with us for so long that I still even occasionally hear my husband calling her name. It's a habit. This is what we do. It's, you know, and the kids will remind me, you know, this is Kakak's baju when Kakak's this. And we still talk about her in memory of her because of how much we love her. But we knew we all have to move forward as well. But it's important that we knew we had that person in our life who was so brave, you know, who was meant so much to all of us.
And part of that moving forward while also holding on to her memories, of course, the book.
Yes.
You know, how long did it take you to write it, to set down what you wanted the world to remember of your daughter?
Quick. I wrote it in eight months. I did it quickly. I pretty much focused myself on writing because I knew that, as with memory, as with all of us, we will forget. So it was important that I had everything down, you know, and just write it all down quickly.
What do you hope other parents can learn from your story?
Just love your kids. I think even if they make mistakes, let them make mistakes. Let them make little ones. Just guide them through the big ones, because you're never going to learn through your mistakes. So, and listen to them, talk to them, have lunches with them, little things, you know, focus on the little things in life and the time you have with them, because actually it's very little you don't have that much time. I had that much time with her. And even now, I miss doing all the little things I did with her because each child is different. They're all individuals. So they all need to be treated differently. You know, you can't dump them in one say, okay, you're all my kids. They're each different. So they need different attention and different sort of, you know, attention.
Right at the start of the interview, you talked about how you wanted to do this because you wanted her story to be remembered. You wanted her story to be remembered even after you aren't around anymore. With the writing of the book, with the launching coming up, did you achieve what you wanted from it? Do you feel that this is what you set out to do?
The thing about being a mom, you never feel that you've done enough. I mean, she's passed and I still want to do something for her. I still want to write for her. And I think I will never feel that I've done enough. So, I don't know. I hope I can help other parents now in remembrance of her because I'm pretty sure there are many moms like me who just can't say it or can't express themselves. So, I hope to help other moms or anyone, you know, in remembrance of Marissa, of what she went through.
Caring for Marissa will be launched this Sunday, 10:30 a.m. at the Hideout Cafe and will be available in bookstores the following week. For more information, do visit the book's Facebook page by searching Caring for Marissa. Marhaini, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Marhaini Mustafa, author of Caring for Marissa, a memoir of grief and healing. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.